Welcome to today's program. I'm Rick Mullaney, the director of the Public Policy Institute at Jacksonville University, and welcome to Policy Matters, WJCT's quarterly radio program that takes a close look at public policy issues that matter to you and to the future of our city, state, and nation. Thank you for being with us. On our program today, we are very pleased to have two special guests, one a leader in Congress and the other a leader on the Jacksonville City Council. Today, we are pleased to have on the program Congressman Al Lawson, who represents the 5th Congressional District of Florida, which includes much of Jacksonville and stretches to Tallahassee, and in the second half of our program, Jacksonville City Council President Anna Brochet. Congressman Lawson, welcome to the program, and thanks so much for being with us.
It's a real privilege to be with you this morning.
Thank you, Congressman. I know that you just finished just your first 7 months as a first-term congressman in Congress, and someone else just finished their first 7 months, the president, President Trump. And I think Republicans and Democrats would agree that we probably haven't seen 7 months quite like this. So I wanted to ask you directly, how do you grade President Trump's performance over the first 7 months? And what are your comments on this presidency?
I would have to grade him a C-. My comments on the presidency, since I've been there the last 7 months, he has really created more and more of a divide in Congress, and staying in the campaign mode and not really working with Democrats or Republicans that much to really accomplish all that we can for the American people. And that is a very Congress, when I first got there, was very difficult for me to understand why it was so partisan. Because people did not send us up there to be partisan. They sent us up there to work on their behalf. I think it's a situation where some congressional people have forgotten who they really represent. They do not represent each other, trying to keep their party to stay in step with their party, but to stay in step with the public that they really represent. And so that was very difficult. I happened to be in the 115 class and it's 50 of us that Harvard University is doing research on. And they stated early on that this is the class that they feel that can start to break up a lot of the gridlock.
Congressman, I think you've touched on something that is a great concern to people throughout the country, and that is this partisan divide. And let me ask you, this past week, and from your answer, I suspect you've said that you believe the presence may be contributing to that divide. This week, we saw three speeches by the president that kind of show three different Donald Trumps. On Monday, a speech on Afghanistan, a very serious speech. On Tuesday, a speech in Phoenix in which his critics believed he was over the top and some said unhinged. A speech yesterday on Wednesday, which was more measured. And some critics, very severe critic, James Clapper, the former director of National Intelligence, actually said he believed he was unfit to serve as president. Very strong criticism. Do you believe the president is unfit to serve as president?
Well, I say the president's comments were very disturbing. And I've always felt that we needed a leader who can rise above the political fray and set moral standards for the country instead of a leadership that's going to keep us divided. I really hated to say after 7 months that a person is unfit to be president.
Yes.
Simply due to the fact that being a president is a tough job. I mean, it's a real tough job. And so because you don't just represent a party, but you represent everybody in America. You know, you're concerned about safety. You're concerned about international affairs. You know, and so as a result, you know, you certainly hope that the next 6 months that you can really do that evaluation. Some people, because we are so accustomed over the last 50 or 60 years, how other presidents act. And now all of a sudden we have a president is totally unorthodox compared to the way policy has been formed, the way relationships are reformed. And so some people are eager to jump to the fact hey, this guy, you know, is not going to work because we've never seen anything like it before. But I think what we have to do is to try to see as we move forward. I want the president to be successful.
Yes.
I want any president to be successful because it's good for America.
Well, let me ask you in one area potentially where there may be agreement, and hopefully, and I think you've expressed a sentiment towards trying to address this partisan divide and maybe be successful. On Monday night, he gave a speech that was actually supported by many, a very, what you might call a teleprompter speech, but one on Afghanistan, and one in which he candidly admitted that he was changing his position from the campaign, in which he was favoring withdrawing from Afghanistan, to one in which he believed it would be a great mistake, that would be a haven for terrorists, and he wanted to go after terrorists in Afghanistan, but he wasn't going to give a timeline on troop deployments. Do you agree with the president that it would be a mistake to withdraw from Afghanistan?
Well, I don't know whether I totally agree. I mean, we have already started to withdraw troops from Afghanistan. It's a concern that he did not, after coming out of the campaign, really talk to those people in the military that were really involved to see whether it's in America's best interest to leave troops over there or deploy more troops. But what he did is he used campaign rhetoric. And you'll see the same thing that happened in Arizona. The president is more comfortable in a campaign mode and saying things that really are untrue, things that get people all riled up, you know, create different kinds of emotions. And right now, the reason why that speech was considered to be very good because, you had... people, especially military people involved, in giving an accounting of just what the conditions are and what do we need to do. Because, you know, this has been going on for about 16 years, and we are not winning the war. We don't want another Vietnam. But we're not winning, but we are also concerned about the safety of America, and to make sure that we get help from Palestine. And other places that is so necessary about terrorist attacks.
What policy, and you're right, it is a longstanding war. It is 16 years. We have been there a long time, and Afghanistan has been the graveyard for many nations who've gone in there to try to succeed, and we're struggling. What policy do you favor towards Afghanistan and the region? In particular, I know that the president talked about Pakistan, and he talked about the surrounding countries and a concern for a regional approach. What would you deploy more troops? Would you withdraw troops? This is a really tough question, obviously, a very tough policy call. But what do you lean towards? What do you favor as the policy in Afghanistan?
Well, what I favor is what I've learned since I've been there. And I don't think that we need to put more troops in Afghanistan. We aren't winning, we are not the police of the world. And as a result, my feeling is that if you talk to anyone who's been, I was talking to some people yesterday who have been to Afghanistan, and to hear the soldiers who have left there and say, we are not winning, no matter what kind of technology we have, we are not getting help from other people, and everybody over there really want to come back. There are a lot of people making a lot of money as a result of us being in Afghanistan, and so the general public, they really don't know exactly, but we have started the withdrawal, and I think that's the policy that we should be about. I don't know when we get back in September, when we were getting more briefings on what's going on, I might be able to intelligently answer that question for you.
Well, Congressman, the very next night, and I appreciate your response, the very next night on Tuesday, the president was in Phoenix, and unlike the very measured, sobering tone of the night before, this was more campaign rally-like, like you described, and he once again went to a defense of his response to Charlottesville. And I would like for you as an African-American congressman to give me your view on how you perceive the president's handling of Charlottesville and the effect it has on the divide in his leadership.
I stated early, we need a leader who can rise above the political fray. Instead, we have seen time and time again the failure of the president to do that. There is no place in our society for this kind of a hatred towards one another. We must stand unified and condemn white supremacy. neo-Nazi and Ku Klux Klan groups. We must stand united against any kind of bigotry in order to bring America together.
Well, you know,
President.
Yes, sir.
You know, last week I wore purple in recognition of Haley losing her life on a peaceful demonstration.
Yes.
And people were encouraged all across America. The president did not even call the family. You know, because the president is concerned about his image, he did not denounce them. He had to come back to denounce them because people in his party and everybody else was telling him, even his daughter stepped up to the plate. So as a result, it's just a sad day in America when you can't get Democrats and Republicans to come together for the benefit of the citizens in this country. It's not a fight between Democrats and Republicans after politics are over. It is about taking care of the American people. And the president does not understand that. And that's, I listened to the Arizona rally. An Arizona rally get people with emotions, and the president need to realize that. He's been around for a long time. He knows exactly what he's doing. Those kind of emotions spills over into the streets. It causes people to be angry with each other, to protest, to fight against each other, when all we want to do is have a better quality of life for our families, affordable health care, you know, educational opportunity for our kids. We all want the same kind of thing. Why do you want Americans to fight against each other? You know, why would you go on national television and talk about some of the top leaders in the Republican Party in Congress that has committed their life, you know, to politics and to the American people?
Well, Congressman, let me ask you, well, I think I really appreciate your sentiments. Congressman, we're a little short on time, but I do want to have an opportunity to talk about you very briefly. I'm sorry we've run. I wish we had more time. You've just finished your first 7 months as a first-term congressman representing the 5th Congressional District of Florida. During this time, what have you found to be some of your greatest challenges, and what do you think so far have been your greatest successes?
Well, I think my greatest challenge has been working in the Democratic leadership about the political divide, and to express to the leadership how we need to work on more areas. For example, I came to Washington with the idea that I would actually be able, with my insurance background, to work in the area to improve the Affordable Care Act, because it was a major problem. But there's no perfect legislation. But the party was not able to move in that direction right now, simply because they had hang-ups, you know, on, hey, we know we lost 20-some members when the Affordable Care Act passed, and let them wallow in their own mud. And that's not what I was looking for. I was looking for intelligent people, political, astute people who were saying, yes, we're going to work on the other side. We need to fix this. It's not my people are not concerned about whose name is on the Affordable Care Act. They just want affordable health care. You know, but in Washington, they were concerned about whose name is on it. What's it going to call it? It's Obamacare. It's not HCA. It's Obamacare, because that's what you win elections on. I learned that Congress is really broken. You know, I didn't think it was as broken when I got there, but it's really broken. And so, you know, what we want to do is try to fix it. Now, the thing that bothered me the most when I had this leader's breakfast, and I try to be conscious of time, when I found out that one in every five constituents in Duval County have food insecurity, that was extremely important. So I wanted to call leaders together to let them know, you know, that we need to really work and I'm on the Agriculture Committee to make sure the president recommendation to cut back on food and nutrition for people who need it is unacceptable. 142,000 Duval County residents have to rely on food stamps over a 12-month period of time, one in every five.
Congressman, I got to tell you, I'm really appreciative for this insight. Where I'm afraid we're running a little short on time, and so I want to thank you for your service. I want to thank you for being on our program and for your comments here today.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're listening to Policy Matters on WJCT 89.9 FM. I'm Rick Mullaney with the Public Policy Institute at Jacksonville University. Please stay with us for the second half of our program, in which we're very pleased to have City Council President Anna Brashay.
Many people in Jacksonville never come in contact with those outside their core communities. WJCT is embarking on a journey called Beyond the Core to start a citywide conversation about what unites the people who call Duval County home and what makes our smaller communities unique. We might have an upcoming Beyond the Core listening event in your neighborhood. Check WJCTnews.org to find out.
Welcome back to Policy Matters on WJCT 89.9 FM. I'm Rick Mullaney with the Public Policy Institute at Jacksonville University, and we're very pleased the second half of our program to have the President of the City Council, Anna Brashay, as our guest. Anna, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Anna, there are lots of things to talk about, but it seems like topic number one for Jacksonville, and really, quite frankly, around the nation and the state, has been Confederate statues and monuments. There's lots of things to talk about, but this certainly has been a big topic.
Sure.
Immediately after Charlottesville, you outlined a proposal regarding the relocation of monuments and statues. How about explaining to our listeners exactly what your proposal is?
Sure. Well, what I did was I asked for an internal for departments at the city to prepare an inventory of our Confederate monuments, memorials, and markers within our 840 plus square miles. You know, I mentioned that I had a desire to relocate so that we could contextualize historically what we have and use them as opportunities to actually broaden the education about our history. At the end of the day, we really need to understand what we have, why it was erected, when it was erected, what are the legal implications of even considering moving forward. So my inventory request was step one of what I believe is a process and a conversation for the community.
Now, that's step one for the inventory. I take it what's included and what's not included.
Right.
I take it what's not included, for example, would be school names, which would be the school district or other sorts of discussions. Yours is limited to, and also what wouldn't be included would be private property. So
that's
your
right.
Discussion is an inventory of city property.
Yes, an inventory of Confederate monuments, memorials, and markers on public property,
Public property. And so what is step two after you get your inventory? They come back and they say, we want to report to the city council president that we have the following 23 monuments and statues throughout the county on public property. What do we do then?
Well, step two is understanding what's there and determining if there is sufficient context and history and legal advice and all of the above. There's really more of an inventory of what we have. There's an inventory of what steps are even an option, what steps are even possible before we move forward. And so, and there's got to be a community conversation. You know, we've certainly been having that at city council meetings. I've certainly been receiving communications via email, proposals, ideas for, you know, in opposition. And it's an inventory of that, too, to determine what is the right next step.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more on the community conversation. I do. I think most there is a consensus, at least on that, mm-hmm. that there should be a community conversation. So whatever the future holds, there's an opportunity for people to speak. As you go through this process, as you do your inventory of what we have, as you consider the inventory of what the legal possibilities are, and we have the conversation, does that then lead to a potential step three? Does it lead to potential legislation, and what might that address?
Well, it does. Legislation is an option, and that's what I'm outlining in terms of, you know, who has the authority to relocate monuments, for under what process. And so those are questions being answered right now. And legislation is an option. Relocation is an option. But there are a lot of options, and I'm hearing about lots of solutions from the community.
So do you have a timeline?
I don't at this time. I mean, I don't know when I'm even going to receive the inventory. So this is all in flux and in flow. And as I do have one, I certainly look forward to updating the community.
So it certainly sounds like the beginning of a community conversation that will go probably at least to the end of this year, if not beyond.
The very beginning of a conversation. And I have no idea the timeline.
Okay. Well, let me shift a little bit. We've gotten in the practice of asking every new incoming city council president. You took office July 1st, and we are now in August. And, of course, the mayor gives his budget address in July. You have to finish the budget by the end of September. So for you, what are your top priorities as the incoming city council president?
So I would frame my top priorities in connection with the special committees that I established as soon as my presidency started, the first of which is a special committee on the opioid epidemic. Councilman Gelliford has been doing some great work and leading the charge in terms of understanding what role the community, what role the city should play in this very challenging epidemic, not only facing Jacksonville, but across the nation. And so there's a group of council members focused on that. My second...
Can I ask on that for a second?
Oh, sure.
On the opioid, do we have some preliminary numbers? Certainly, we have seen some staggering numbers from around the country about how serious this problem is. And part of the question would be is how serious is it here in Jacksonville?
Well, we do have numbers. And as a part of that special committee, Councilman Gelliford has been reporting on that. But it's changing. It's continuing to increase. I don't remember off the top of my head exactly what that is, but staggering percentage increases in the numbers of opioid deaths that we're seeing. And as a matter of fact, the medical examiner is sending over daily numbers to the council members so that we can stay apprised of exactly how serious this is for our community.
What are some of the... Now, I take it Mr. Gulliford's going to be the chair of this committee?
Yes, he is.
And part of that would be, I assume, to make some potential recommendations on how to move forward with
this
epidemic.
That's right.
What are some of the range of possibilities of how we as a community can begin to address the opioid epidemic?
We passed legislation under his leadership or under his proposal to have a pilot program for a number of agencies. I know you're aware of one of them, but Gateway and River Region, and in concert with the Research Department of UF Health, understanding exactly, you know, what is the scope of the challenge for us and how can the community be involved? How should the city be involved? How should government be involved? And how does it affect the entire community on a long-term basis when we have these, you know, very serious challenges ahead of us?
Before we go to your second special committee, I do want to mention to our listeners, you're listening to Policy Matters on WJCT 89.9 FM. I'm Rick Mullaney, the director of the Public Policy Institute at Jacksonville University, and we are very, very pleased to have the president of the Jacksonville City Council, Anna Brochet, as our special guest here this morning. So, not to interrupt, but you have a second special committee that you're setting up. What is that?
I do. The second of three is a special committee on safe and healthy neighborhoods. Not all of our neighborhoods would our residents, our taxpayers, our constituents say are safe and healthy. And so really we want to understand how the city can deploy resources to evaluate opportunities that we can lift up our neighborhoods and for the community to feel like these are safe and healthy neighborhoods. So we're building a model to identify certain areas within each district to, providing a range of services, whether that's municipal code compliance, whether that's our blight team, is there some involvement of JSO in some capacity, on and on. Victim services, you know, a whole range of city services, and how is it that we make sure that everyone can be proud of their neighborhood?
You know, a surprising aspect of this, quite frankly, and I think it would surprise some of our listeners, maybe food. Mm-hmm. In the first half of our program, Congressman Lawson mentioned that with community leaders here, he was stunned that one in five in Jacksonville, as he put it, was having trouble with access to nutrition and to healthy food. I'm now part of a group that's working on, actually it's being driven by the Duval County Medical Society on food deserts here in Duval County. And the challenge of providing access to healthy food countywide. And I think people would be surprised at what a challenge that is. Is that within the scope? Is that something this committee will be addressing?
I don't know. Councilman Reggie Brown is leading the committee, and I happen to be on it, so it very well could be. And it is a challenge. That definitely falls under the purview of making sure that our neighborhoods are safe and healthy. And with our 840 square miles, it is a challenge to make sure that people have access to food. And it's a really important part of our community to make sure that we are setting everyone on a path for health.
It's sort of a surprising issue, quite frankly, isn't it? I think most people would think in 2017 that this food desert problem, this notion that parts of our very big counties you just outlined really would not have access to healthy foods. I think it's a really good topic for your committee.
Thank you.
You're doing it. And I think it's a surprising issue, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. I think most people in Duval County would be surprised that so many in Duval County are struggling.
Yes.
Your third committee.
My third committee is a special committee on parks. And we have a very large urban park system and over 400 parks and community centers. And, you know, we've heard some challenges from time to time that we're not proud of our park system. Not all of them are intended to be active, but I'd like for us to understand, and we've done some research in the past, let's refresh where we are and determine how is it that we can make sure that we have quality parks, they're maintained, they're accessible. And I'd really like to see the role that our parks, you know, enhancing the role that our parks can play in youth engagement and youth development. I know that I spent every day of my childhood in at least one of two parks growing up. They were definitely a part of my social and emotional development, and I just don't think that that's where we are today. I know society's different and everybody's busy, but you know, our parents and grandparents would like to make sure that they know that their kids and grandchildren are safe in our parks and that we have activities that can help build character and leadership and connectivity with nature and with friends.
Do you expect this committee to come back with some specific recommendations and what that price tag might be, for example?
That's exactly what I'm looking for, is how do we capitalize on what's going well in our parks? How do we spread that to other parks and make sure that the rest of the community is connecting through our parks? And what does that cost? And how is it that we can move forward and implement such a plan?
Now, you know, it may be a little bit beyond the scope of this committee, but certainly one of the things I hear a lot, I'm sure you do too, is the frustration they have with the walkability when it comes to Jacksonville, mm-hmm. that we certainly are a city that's tied to its cars. And you're seeing a lot of efforts to try to make it more accessible and more walkable. Is that something that either this committee may talk about a little bit, maybe certainly within the park system, but even beyond during your presidency, this whole notion of walkability and access here in Duval County?
Walkability is important. And, you know, our strengths become our weaknesses, and we are a sprawling city. But the combination of the work that's happening in safe and healthy neighborhoods and the parks, you know, those, we want to connect our parks and our neighborhoods and make sure that we're all using the assets that we have. And walkability is important. Safety is important in that process.
Well, we're a little short on time, but there's a couple other big policy issues facing the city. I just want to touch on them,
sure.
Although these are much bigger topics than the short time we have for them. One will be deepening our port. Certainly for many years, we've talked about going from 40 feet to 47 feet. Some of this is a result of bringing those bigger cargo ships, and especially with the improvements to the Panama Canal. However, there have been a lot of people who've come forward saying that they have environmental concerns or that the economic case hasn't been made. What is your position? Do you favor the deepening of our port from 40 to 47 feet?
The port is a major asset for our, not only our city, but our region. And I'm confident that we can move forward with an opportunity to remain competitive as it relates to our port, but also being very mindful and careful and thoughtful about the environmental impacts of doing so. I do support harbor deepening.
And for the last piece of our conversation, the budget is due at the end of September. What are your impressions or your opinion about the budget that was presented, and what do you hope to accomplish with that budget by the end of September?
Well, Mayor Curry has done a great job. This is his third budget that he's proposed, and the budget reflects, you know, the priorities that he established when he was campaigning and everything that he has said since then. I am certainly interested, and they're actually probably discussing and we will be continuing to discuss the Kids Hope Alliance and the reform of the Children's Commission and the journey. And it's an important, I said early on that the way that this city wraps itself around our children is the most important investment that we can make. And so this is a big deal and something that we'll be looking through very thoughtfully and carefully.
Well, that's the final word for today's program. We're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us, and thank you so much for listening. You've been listening to Policy Matters on WJCT. My name is Rick Mullaney. I'm the director of the Public Policy Institute at Jacksonville University. Thank you for being with us, and hope you'll be with us again next time.